Should we say hello to the listeners?
Yeah. Hello, listeners. I'm George.
I'm Luke.
This is the bonus.
Yeah.
I think this is going to be pretty rambling from my end.
Okay, yeah.
I got a lot of ideas.
If we'd been doing this maybe a couple of years ago, I think that the temptation to be a bit glib about it would have been much stronger. But I think sort of, like, we have to tread much more carefully on this terrain than perhaps we would have had to before, just because of the times.
I'd hope I'd always be a bit down on the fascists. The Italian fascists are a completely different beast to the Nazis, but they're a terrible bunch of people. Yeah. Mussolini was a thug. He was expelled from school for stabbing the other pupils. He was known for being extraordinarily and prodigiously violent from the age of six. He was a fraud. Their regime thrived on the myth of masculine strength. They went around beating people up and burning down their houses, left, right, and centre. They were a terrible bunch. And I think it's a terrible tragedy that people were taken in by this crap.
Yes. I think what's difficult, or what presents a problem, is that on the one hand, it's natural to view the monuments of an era like that with a certain degree of caution, and to view them with a kind of like fear of contagion in mind, you know, that they might be infectious in some way. But at the same time, I think if you were to look really critically at the architecture of the post-war, and especially actually at the architecture or where modern architecture has ended up in the contemporary period, I mean, arguably a quite washed out version of Italian rationalist architecture is basically the hegemonic style of Western European modern architecture, isn't it? I mean,
well, we're talking about kind of like Chipperfield.
Yeah.
Maybe, well, loads of people. Swiss architecture in
general.
Well,
just think about what housing looks like now.
New London vernacular is essentially fascist. But also the postmodernism of the 80s was heavily leaning on fascist principles.
Yeah, the New London vernacular is kind of Italian rationalism put through the sort of Minecraft filter of building information modelling, isn't it? It's the like losing something of the crispness of the detail.
But it also never went away. It struck me that having looked, what's he called, the Frenchman who Adam wrote the book on?
Pouillon.
Pouillon seems very fascist influence to me.
Yeah, or that he's communing with the same ideas. I think Diane Girardot is who wrote the sort of main kind of accusatory article on this, pointing out how even the most abstract rationalists are very implicated in the ideology of fascism. And the key term is hierarchy, gerarchia. But people in the post-war get into exactly the same thing. They just call it something different. They call it meaning, or they call it the civic, or they call it regionality, or character. You know?
Well, character and regional, those are the people who lean slightly more on the Nazis, I'd say.
Well, I don't know. I mean, like, the regionality also features in...
There are definitely the regional schools in Italian fascism, yeah.
Critical regionalism. Who's that? Is that Ken Frampton? You know, yeah. They are prescient, whether we would want to acknowledge it or not. To an extent, their architecture identifies a bit before everyone else the kind of dilemma of modernism and history is going to explore in the post-war era and afterwards.
In France and Germany, the modern avant-garde had no truck with the academy, and the academy had no truck with the modern avant-garde, really. And it's not that the Italians were less prone to writing rules and books, or less prone to reading them, or that the seminal texts were less influential, or even that individuals didn't have incredibly strong feelings about this style being right and this style being wrong. But there was always the bulk of people working were happy to rob any architectural style from history and the contemporary and synthesize it. And there was a great strain of that. And so the struggle of integrating some of the ideas of modernity around efficiency, around stripping back ornament, and the modern form, the industrial form, the new form sort of shorn of history, kind of combining that with type, and in a way also breaking down the sort of technical ideas of a city as a kind of machine, and using the building styles that were a bit like that, but using them to build much more historically and normally, they were capable of being urban in a way that, like, Corb struggled with.
Well, how about shall I sketch the landscape of Italian fascism? Let me just say that that within the period that we're looking at, there is an avant-garde end, and there is a reactionary end, and there is a big and complicated middle ground, and that the avant-garde, one of the things which is unusual about Italian fascism is that far from being the kind of degenerate target as they were in Germany, the avant-garde in the form of the futurist movement is kind of part of the rise of fascism and are really in from the beginning. So you need to go back to the beginning of futurism, which you can trace to F.T. Marinetti's manifesto, which was published in Le Figaro in 1909. It's often seen as kind of firing the starting pistol for the era of these sort of modernistic manifesto culture, isn't it? It's one of the early ones, and it's a particularly wild and excessive one. War is good, the machine is good, everything of the past is kind of excremental and to be destroyed. The future is about continuous movement and continuous change. There has to be a total revolution in aesthetics and in every aspect of everyday life. There's a kind of joy and a reveling in the necessary violence of that process as well.
Yes, in what they regard as the essential violence. They say war is the truly energizing force. It is the only creative force. But at the same time as saying that, Marinetti himself and the first wave of futurists are immensely contradictory. It's hard to think of people like this today. It seems so implausible. In some sense, the society there is really hidebound and academist. They are, on the one hand, writing these manifestos about war and machinery. The best artists in that movement at the beginning are painting...
Yeah, we should say, so there's his first manifesto, but then there's essentially a more or less annual event of successive manifestos by other people, which are the futurist manifesto of, e.g., sculpture, painting.
The new city.
Well, they build up to architecture in 1914. And each of those people, I think that Marinetti had a certain amount of influence and would make changes. Certainly that's the case in the architectural one, which is authored by Anthony Sant'Elia.
And also co-authored by, begins with C, the guy who is perpetually brushed out of history for surviving the First World War.
Oh, the other guy doing the drawings.
He's absolutely not included in the sort of subsequent history, but he did a lot of the work.
Oh, yeah, Mario Ciattone.
Ciattone, yeah.
Yeah. Or Ciattone, I don't know how you pronounce it. Yeah, no, I mean, Sant'Elia did a lot of the...
He did
the main drawings, and he was a prodigiously talented drawer. They didn't have all that long to do it, because they had between 1909 and 1914, and true to their principles, at the outbreak of the First World War in 1914, they all signed up and joined the wonderfully named Lombard Cyclists Battalion, and went off to war and were killed. And
yeah, not all of them were killed, but lots of them were. It's much more a movement of visual and plastic arts at this time than it is an architectural. The architectural is really those two.
Yeah, so Sant'Elia's stuff, which is pretty famous, you've probably seen.
Popular on posters.
I sort of would dispute whether they're even really buildings. They're more, I think someone else has said this, they're really landscapes, and they are compellingly sort of machine age and futuristic, but they're nevertheless still articulated in a style which is recognisably late Art Nouveau, or influenced by Otto Wagner. These kind of fluid lines, for example.
But they're huge sort of things that look like they're somewhere between towers of apartment buildings or hydro dams, or is it a power station?
Yeah, they're cities in which all you have is like power stations everywhere, yeah. and you know, motorways kind of flying through them all.
The kind of deco power stations.
Yeah, they're amazing. I've got a book of his drawings, and they do reward close examination.
There's a lot of art. It's the first generation is about capturing the mass, speed and motion, but in quite everyday settings and objects. In a way, it's not the speed of like jet engines and trains, it's the speed of children scampering along the pavement. And the energizing war, like they kind of imagine, you know, there's collages of people at cafes becoming cavalry charges.
Yeah, I mean, rather like Généret and Aux Enfants, they still are interested in working in particular established modes like still life, but infusing them with this completely new spirit, which I think in the case of still life is not about painting the objects, but about painting the relationship between the object and its sort of charged atmosphere around it.
I guess they were looking to cubism and thinking what you can do after that and what you can do after Duchamp's. The motion is kind of like Duchamp's woman descending stairs. Then they're mainly not absolutely brilliant.
In the architectural manifesto, there are lots of things which Marinetti had put in which were not there originally, like in the future, everyone, we have to keep knocking down everything and every generation has to rebuild its own buildings. And it's very much like a brand, the futurists. Marinetti, who lives through the war and kind of goes on and then works with a second generation of younger futurists who to replace all the ones that he's lost. He's a great recruiter of artists. And he kind of chooses ones who he thinks are going to work. They can more or less decide what futurism is as long as he's happy with it. And then he kind of accumulates the valor of their particular successes. But then he also gets involved with a few other projects. During the war, actually, in 1915, he had formed a budding bromance with Benito Mussolini in 1915, when they were jointly arrested at a pro-war demonstration, which was agitating for Italy to enter the Great War. And their wish, of course, was granted, with terrible consequences for most of the members of the movement.
Yeah, you really don't want to fight in the Dolomites. It's very steep. The things that they're very famous for before the fascists come to power are kind of very silly installation art, silly performance art, where they'd sort of dress up in loud coloured suits and play an ensemble piece for vacuum cleaner, piano and car horn while sort of doing stuff that would feels rather like kind of YBA.
Yeah, they're kind of doing art. They're doing kind of Dada.
Yeah, Swiss Dada.
They're willing to do a bit of all of it.
He writes he's involved in two big manifestos, one of which is the Futurist Cooking Manifesto and the other one is the Fascist Political Manifesto.
I remember one of the recipes is there are two hemispheres, one of butter and one of anchovies. That's one of the recipes.
There's lots of things sort of enrobed in raw liver. Nearly all of them have been done at one time or another. It's much better than like Salvador Dali's cookbook. But I mean, it's all nonsense. They're really weird because they've got this kind of like ISIS edge where they're really into like this death cult. But they're also like outrageous hipsters.
Yes, he is a real... It's a very contemporary type. Marinetti is a hipster fascist.
Yeah.
Like the guy who made the Proud Boys or whatever. Like Project One was Found Vice magazine. Project Two was make a white supremacist group.
Yeah, violence worship. Violence is the only creative force. It's not that we need to go to war about anything or with anyone in particular. It is that war is the end in itself.
But so he was involved in the Fascist Manifesto and...
There's basically two people who write it. There's a politician and him.
Certainly he had some initial political ideas which don't... I'm not sure if all of them got into the manifesto itself.
The Fascist Manifesto is not completely nuts. It's also literally a political manifesto for an election. So it has a lot of, we're going to raise the retirement age.
Marinetti's demands were the abolition of four things, the monarchy, parliament, the institution of marriage, and the papacy, which I'm not sure all of those got into the manifesto, but it was recognised that the first fascist manifesto was a bit out there and has harmed their chances with certain groups. So, and they toned it down a bit in the subsequent ones.
Well, I mean, they're a funny movement because at one level, they're a personality cult for Mussolini, who loved running around bare-chested, hammering down walls and bringing in the harvest and, you know, being photographed everywhere. They're a populist political movement that's neither really on the left nor the right. It believes in social welfare, generous pensions, and it's also fascist.
Yeah, that's the classic fascist formulation, is sort of social welfare but with a strongly racialized category for eligibility.
But it wasn't particularly until the mid to late 30s, it wasn't like anti-Semitic. The people they were killing were socialists, and there's a very deep-rooted communist. But like, if the area isn't really into like madly into Catholicism, it's probably madly into communism.
The thing is that Futurism, although it's the first avant-garde, it's not the only avant-garde movement in which has an involvement in the, or which has a place within the terrain of Italian fascist architecture.
The fascists, although they had a futurist writing their manifesto, they never really signed up to Futurism. It was never the house style. And Futurism, as we've also said, never really has a style.
It doesn't, and it's not hugely... There are some Futurist buildings, which I think... I mean, there are one or two which are worth talking about. There's a guy I hadn't come across before, Fortunato De Pero, who produces this amazing pavilion, which is all letters. You can... Where they succeed, they look like things which could probably also be Lenin's mausoleum or something like that.
Constructivist, yeah. And they did a lot of the like typography posters that you would think of
as constructionist. Yeah, yeah, yeah. De Pero did the famous futurist poster which got ripped off by Peter Saville for that New Order movement album cover. Very stylish and fair game, you know. So you have the futurists who are one of the avant-gardes. There is an avant-garde of a younger generation which emerges during the 1920s, who are the rationalists, who are broadly younger architects. The most prominent of them is, or the most famous is Giuseppe Terragni. But there are lots of others. And Michelucci was sort of somewhat aligned with them at certain times. Yeah. He had exhibited his work in one of their exhibitions.
It's worth saying they are more they're less expressionist, more conventionally modernist, and also slightly historical at times. Not always.
They have a strong opinion of Le Corbusier and also of developments in German architecture. They take the view that Le Corbusier has been, as I think we do, that Le Corbusier has been read too straightforwardly as being about the worship of the machine in architecture, and that his idea of a kind of historical grounding of the fundamentals of architecture being timeless is extremely important, and that's what they choose to foreground instead. The operation that they pursue is typological. It's about looking at these, trying to categorize these fundamental types of like essential architecture and then performing this abstracting kind of essentialization on them, saying, you know, we can turn the fundamental form of whatever it happens to be, the basilica or something, into this very, often very stark, abstract form in the language of industrial building materials, but which nevertheless holds on to and conveys its essential meaning and enable, you know, facilitates sort of proper civic building within the urban context. Just to sketch the rest of the terrain, you have the reactionaries, who are, I think they're called the academists. So you have among them people who just actually want to do neo-Baroque architecture or some variant of it. And then you have a really interesting terrain in the middle, among which is partly filled by either rationalists who go one way or academics who come the other way and meet in the middle. But also there's a group, and who are a little bit awkward to talk about because they don't have a manifesto, called the Novecento, the New Century. They're predominantly northern. Their leader, or like perceived leader, is this guy, Giovanni Muzio, who we talked about very briefly in the main episode. He has a famous building called Cabruta, the ugly house in Milan. They are people who have like a very erudite understanding of history, a huge knowledge of historical motifs. If you look at Cabruta, what it does, which is typical, is that it has these very large masses. It doesn't attempt to hide its mass by breaking it up or having some kind of organic metaphor which occludes its simple massiveness. What it does, though, is to wallpaper the outside with these stripes of quite strange, intricate, planar, rather mannered motifs of different kinds, which have the effect of breaking it up visually, but which don't break it up formally. So it's still effectively a grid across the face of the building. It doesn't hide from the kind of gridded facade as that like essential, you know, this is just the essential like big urban modern building which can't be hidden from, but it deploys all of these kind of little decorative motifs which are drawn from all over. And various people have made the analogy that they are kind of mannerist in that sense, in the sense that they are people who have like a very deep understanding of history, who draw on a very broad set of historical references, but who use these in a way which creates an effect which is a little bit unsettling rather than reassuring. It tends to be destabilizing.
Firstly, of the movement, the other thing, it is a movement which emerges out of painting and is part of the general return to order. The Car Brutto has a couple of more things going on as well. It's two buildings with a newly created road between them, and between that is a sort of recreation of a Roman triumphal arch, which is made in very flat stone. The different bands of material both register essentialized different sorts of ornament, but also feel slightly like a leveling back of a kind of Roman ruin, where you see the tier of stone remaining and then the bare brick, and then the facade is thick and tough, although it's quite flat mostly. You can see this toughness and thickness, and then it's divided into these twin masses with a ceremonial route through, which is talking about the edge of the city and about a city block. Like the way Rossi talks about the urban district, it feels very appropriate to that. It's like a recreated history, but it's also explicitly new, and it feels new. Even the triumphal arch is completely essentialized, and it's perfect in a way that it wouldn't be. But it also is a building where, like Rossi's column in Venice, it generates its own essentialized inclusions. There's these like weird bits of stone coming out on the private road. And the arch itself is set in as if the building was built around it.
It also has these grotesque elements. So this, you can see this picture, that's one of the doorways, which is quite an amazing assemblage. It's got these two very, very thick, totally unadorned pillars with a slightly smaller gap in between. So it reads as this very tall, narrow slot. And then there's a little bit of tiled roof. And then there are these two like obelisks on top of it.
They're very popular, those obelisks. A lot of people were doing them, but they come from the Mad Academist end, where they loved them.
And then on the top of that, there are there's like a bit of a column capital, which seems to have got lost and is balancing on top of the void. And then there's a little window.
And it feels like it's reusing old components. And it also feels like it's reaching back to original Roman models.
But there are other people who are also doing it. So Piero Portaluppi as well is a kind of is part of this movement, who's a real eccentric and another quite fun guy. But so this building has got like an enormous arch through the middle of it. Yeah, again, the windows are expressed as a grid, and then but then there are these. The elements are really strange. There are these big bosses on the facade. There's something which looks like a kind of ceiling grid, but which has been applied to the lower part of it, almost like a form of rustication.
I think it all makes more sense if you think of it as being at least informed by this very louche liberty style that, you know, Gino Copedè, appropriate name, because he would literally take the mass of an existing building, start with that, cut another cut through it, dress it in decoration off another building. And although those buildings are like capricious, they're kind of ridiculous, so are those. Like the Car Brutto is a capriccio, but it's one that is, instead of being informed by fripperous nouveau, it's informed by the sensibility of like De Chirico.
Yeah, so that formerly the masses, there's no sense of organic growth. Everything expresses itself as these sort of straightforward, planar, big masses, and then everything is applied.
But I mean, that's also what was going on in a lot of the Liberty buildings.
Because they have that Art Nouveau sense of growth, don't they? Like, if you think of the Copedè buildings, there'll be a bit on top of another bit on top of another bit, and it will be kind of reaching up.
Well, there are others in that Liberty style which are boxes or like curved bits of street, which then have these enormous inset stone grotesque decorations, but they're just applied. They play with the notion of a decorated box, really.
I think there's a deliberate way in which they use scale on the Novecento ones, which is different, though, which is that it's a lot about a certain scale and repetition. So rather than like a massive piece of ornamentation on a facade or something which creates this Art Nouveau sense of organicity and movement, it's these static, repeated elements, but which are then combined in complicated ways. And so it's very, very sublimated, but there is a bit of a sense of kind of the factory in that.
But also, like, I keep saying to Kiriko, but like to Kiriko, they're factories and tombs. You can see the similarity between Novecentro, like municipal buildings, and Novecentro war memorials. They're like that. They're this, you know, curving wall of rectangles, except the rectangles have bodies in them.
The closest thing that they have to a manifesto is this exhibition from the 1930s, which in a, I think a characteristically sort of understated way is called Some Architects of Today in Lombardy, where Muzio has a quote. He says, "In place of the exasperated and arbitrary individualism that insists the fame and ability of a designer consists of the originality of invention, it seemed necessary to substitute an order. Only from discipline and a community of feeling would, bit by bit, a new architecture come into the world." Which it could easily be something that you can imagine a like British or Swiss architect of the present kind of.
We're undergoing another return to order now, which is the other name of Novecentro is the return to order. And what they mean by order is some connection to the eternal order of architecture. Rather as it is a movement in painting of some return to the eternal, like mythic archetypes of images of people.
So we can say something about rationalism. Basically, the rationalists emerge in 26. They have an exhibition. I think that the order is they have an exhibition in 1928, and that they then sort of mount a concerted attempt to become the style of the regime, and they make a miscalculation. In the exhibition, they have something called the Table of Horrors, or something like that, which has lots of pictures, including pictures of other contemporary architects' work who they didn't like, and including some of the work of Marcello Piacentini, who was a successful architect in Rome and also the son of a successful architect, and clearly had a lot of the right sorts of connections. They make this attempt. Their hope is that Mussolini will come in on their side, but in fact what happens is that they are had up on disciplinary charges by the architects' syndicate, which was the professional body. And if you wanted to practice architecture, you had to be a member of the syndicate and you had to swear your oath of allegiance and all of that kind of thing. And they're forced to back down and to apologise. And that's the way in which Piacentini manages to affirm his kind of control over the what's going to be the main style of the regime in the commissions that follow. I mean, albeit that actually everyone in every persuasion keeps on getting jobs and keeps on doing jobs all the way through.
As long as you don't speak out against the regime or speak out against the system, you can be able to get quite big state jobs, even when your style is completely off the wall. There's people in the Baroque end, the Rome Zoological Gardens, this big complex, is he called Bruzzi? Who does this huge, completely neo-Baroque, all the Rome Zoological Gardens.
Brazzini. Armando Brazzini.
I've been banging on about him, not because I think he's an amazing architect, but it's so striking that he was able to operate in the same system, on the same commissions, as all these other people, because he's sycophantically trying to become the court architect. He's having some success. He's getting some big public projects.
Does it still exist, this thing?
Yep.
Bloody hell, it's quite a thing. The complex, the good shepherd, the complesso del buon pastore.
This was to be a little girl's orphanage.
It looks like really kinky Hogwarts.
Yeah. It's a Hogwarts where everyone is Slytherin. It's so big, they had to break it up into sort of three schools. It's like Piranesi doing a drawing of an imagined ruin, which is then tarted up by a sort of unbelievably camp third-rate
Baroque architect. Yeah.
Anyway, it's this Baroque, part stone, part brick, crumble of like massive ruins with a completely mad shaped planning. Also, it's got a bit of. It was built in fields outside Rome, and it was built. Groundbreaking 1933, completion 1943. So, for example, after EUR was started. And he's not the only person. There are other, like, the neo-Baroque is quite a big movement.
Yes, and it shows that, like, quite wild stuff was possible within it, isn't it? I mean, there's nothing orthodox about this in any respect.
No, it's not like Baroque.
No.
It's like a Baroque fever dream.
Yeah. I guess to complete the sort of sketch of the styles, what becomes latterly, Piacentini decides to codify his own particular form of architecture, which is this very abstracted, stripped back kind of De Chirico-esque classicism, which he calls the stile littorio, the Lictorian style.
Yeah, those are the people. It's very on brand with fascism. They're the people who carry the fascis.
And he carried that through in a whole series of different projects. There were he did the reconstruction of the center of I think Brescia, and he also did some work in Turin. There are lots of these sort of arcaded, very flat, round arch things with meaningful towers, often convenient places for someone to do a big speech from.
They're not that bad, though. I mean, the best one... the Martyrs in Milan, which is almost, which is sort of halfway between that and Deco.
Oh, the Arengario on the next to the cathedral.
Yeah, which is a memorial for the non-existent martyrs of the March on Rome.
Yeah, I feel a bit guilty about it, but I think it just totally works within this sort of funny urban assemblage that is the centre of Milan. You know, you've got all of these.
It doesn't. It feels completely sensible next to the giant shopping arcade and the giant
and the kind of enormous very late Gothic cathedral. With its facade, I think, done a bit later. And yeah, partly it is that the kind of ideological charge of the building is just a bit desacralized by being submerged in all of these different bits of architectural theatricality.
But it's 100% made for Mussolini to give speeches and to valorize the people who died bringing fascism, bringing the light and transparency of fascism to the Italian people. I think this competition between incredibly radical different styles, all of whom are fawning over the great dictator, desperate to become the court style, they're really driving each other on.
I think also that they were good, like they were very good designers. Like that, the people had essentially really, really good skills, and they obviously had the resources available to try stuff out and to really push things. They obviously had access to some good materials.
I mean, Italian architecture had really got good starting in the 1890s, but it was all this historic stuff in the door. Before then, it's the mid-19th century in Italy is a bit weak.
We should say something. I think Muzio is kind of a big figure, and his later stuff becomes very bricky, and it starts to take on these kind of rationalist grids, really strips back all of the decoration. But still really nice.
Often covered in giant fascis.
Well, they've kind of taken a lot of that off.
Yeah.
I think that a lot of the... Once the fascist stuff is stripped off, a lot of these funny, pompous little buildings do become rather charming. I remember coming across what's now the Camera di Lavoro in Milan, which I think initially was the Palace of the Syndicates, which is this funny little brick building, very, very pompous. It originally had all sorts of bits on top which have been taken off, with this kind of ornate brickwork. And then the entrance has this dark, it's like red brick, and then the entrance has this sort of dark green stone stairway going up, but which is then under its own weight pushing these columns into the ground. These very sort of thick, stripped back kind of Tuscan columns. It's a really charming little building. And viewed with a certain amount of ignorance, which is how I encountered it, and defanged a little bit, I guess, it's a very charming part of the urban assemblage.
I think we could move on to talk about some things that are, in a way, we've been talking round what is thought of as Italian fascist architecture. I mean, we've mentioned one, which is the building in Como, which is a great modernist.
Yeah, do we want to talk about Terragni? Because he's, he is really the leader of, or he's the preeminent rationalist. And he was a northerner. His big works are both in Como. He did a big apartment block, which looks a bit like something that might have been built in the Soviet Union. It's this big stripped back apartment block made out of these primal geometries, a sort of mixture of big cuboids and cylinders. And then there's the Casa del Fascio.
It looks like a sort of 1998 Chipperfield building. And then if you look at it more closely, it's better. I've never been there, so I haven't. Dali's been there. She says it's great.
It's apparently very fascinating. So Peter Eisenman essentially wrote a whole book about this building because he's so fascinated by its formal plasticity and intricacy. It has a grid, really simple grid of windows with then a blank margin beside it, which is repeated on every facade, but which is completely differently figured in each way. So on one facade, they're like a framework almost. In others, they're windows which are sort of set back. In others, they're windows which are on the surface. So there's the same language is kind of investigated and being changed in this way, which totally changes your reading of the formal mass of the building. And then on the inside, it's got mostly a big hall, actually. It's got, like, I think a six-fold gridding in terms of organisation.
Is it all doors across the bottom so the mass can move in and out of the hall?
I think so, yeah. And then I think what you have is like a stripe, a one thick stripe down one side and a two thick stripe down the other side, and then the remaining three in the middle of the big hall. So it's very, like, diagrammatic. Yeah, as you said, it's meant to be completely transparent. It's meant to represent the transparency of government, that the mass can see in and see their representatives
and
doing
move
their...
in and move out.
You could basically take any photo of it within the urban assemblage and it looks amazing.
You can see why Eisenman's liking it so much, because it's a bit like the early houses or like a larger corb, a more blocky corb house, but it's got things which wouldn't be at home there in a way. Although they're all asymmetric, and it's quite asymmetrical, its asymmetry is very striking when it comes up.
It feels, you get a real sense of the metaphysical side of these very abstract forms, that it seems very kind of weighty. It seems very considered. I think its proportions are incredibly carefully designed. It really does feel like the kind of abstraction of some fundamental idea.
Yeah, but I think they are Mies van der Rohe proportions, i.e. what looked perfect, rather than Corb, it's two squares and a half circle.
Yeah, I'm not sure architecture has anywhere to go after the Casa del Fascio. Like, I'm not sure it can be the start of anything. I think it looks like a miraculous dead end. I'm not sure you can go any further down that road.
It's another one of these problems of modernism, which is so modernism in its big heroic era so concentrates the remit of architectural design on these few decisions, because you have already agreed that it's going to be white, cuboidal. And then it becomes a play of very sublimated language and proportion and a few other tricks and sort of sight. You can perfect that, but that's, you can't be wild. And in a way, what the generation after the war has to do is break all that down. And
it's already doing it before the war with these people who were getting into like bricks and other materials and trying to find this interesting middle ground between a kind of absolute abstraction, which is just almost complete, whose historicism is just hovering on the edge of legibility.
Whereas Corbusier's historicism is completely illegible. Like, he says the Bugatti is the same as the Doric column. They're not. I mean, the argument there is that they're both precise and perfect for their function. Whereas it sort of creeps back in. I mean, but it is also a bit like only creeps back in under paranoid analysis when you're really looking at it, I think. It's not superficially present in Tarragni.
Yes, there's a late Tarragni unbuilt project in which the metaphysicality of the architectural concern really breaks out and becomes quite fruity, which is this thing called the Danteum. As it sounds, it's a building about Dante, and it was proposed for this new processional big route that was one of the urban projects for Rome. If fascism had stayed in power a bit longer, they really would have made a big mess of Rome. They just hadn't quite got round to it. They were going to properly Haussmannize it and generally destroy all of its charm, I think.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they started well with a few bits and bobs, and they were no more like that than the previous government.
The Danteum has... they are like narrative spaces. I think it was going to be a museum about Dante, but in which... a bit like when we were talking about Michelucci and the baptistry and the stages you go through in the baptismal.
Do you start in the middle of your life in a dark wood?
Yes, exactly. You start in the middle of your life in a dark wood and you go through Inferno, purgatory and you emerge, the most famous space is what paradise is like, which is this space full of glass columns. I can't quite imagine how it would have worked, but it would like enter and infuse the space with this extraordinary like refracted radiance. Not built, but they did, it was agreed and they were going to do it. But yes, you can see a form of thinking which is at work in that project, which is latent, I think, in the rationalist way of relating to form and meaning generally. So we were going to talk about the big one, weren't we?
Yeah. So first, after year 10, which I think is 1932, the fascists put on their 10-year celebration. And they built a lot of temporary structures with giant fascies and huge lettering and representations of the people. And they had lots of parades. Like, I think they were trying to riff off a Roman triumph, where you've got all these temporary structures expressing, except that instead of it being the leader, who is very present, it's about the mass moving through and together. But they want to do a much bigger one for year 20, 1942. And there's going to be a huge exhibition in a new suburb of Rome, built outside, and it's going to be a new ideal city. And in the new ideal city, there's going to be loads of these. There's going to be the core monument to fascism. There's going to be a hall of the people. There's going to be a concert hall, big concert hall, which I think they didn't actually build until later.
It's very striking as well. If you visit Rome and you fly into Fiumicino, you come in on the very, very straight motorway and you see this complex up on the hill, and you can see it basically the whole time. You can see it for miles. It's quite an amazing sight. If you arrive at night, it's lit up and it's your first view of Rome.
So it's a new planned sub-settlement with big gaps between big buildings on a kind of grid with two axial roads. The non-special buildings are boxes with grids of windows in white. Some of them are marble, I guess a lot of them are rendered. And it spreads out into new suburbs that were, a lot of which were built actually afterwards. And it's now become, and it's now Rome has expanded around it. And then there are these big buildings for the exhibition. The most famous of which is like a square plan tower with a grid of arched rectangular windows, which are unglazed. And then there's a glazing layer kind of step back. So if you can imagine a gallery going all the way around, some of which have kind of Romany, the fascists just loved super buff, very kitsch Roman male naked statues everywhere. As an aside, there's some lovely super camp Roman like gay mosaic of like loads of naked boys on the beach. There's one which is like, you know, naked boys sunbathing, naked boys playing with balls, which I think actually might be riffing off one of the ones in Villa Romano in Sicily, where there's all these in the bathhouse, there are all these like naked boys that are going to towel you down.
Oh yes, young men together romping.
Every good sort of high fascist building will have lots of big marble statues of like super buff guys. Anyway, there's some of those,
and it's got it has an inscription which is a speech by Mussolini, I think.
Yeah, and it really is very De Chirico, except it's white and marble. Feels pretty funereal.
Yeah, the whole place feels like, certainly the ceremonial parts are very empty because there's such big spaces between the buildings.
Well, you're meant to have this, it's built for this huge mass of people to arrive. On opposite that is a big hall, and the whole of the bottom of one thing is glass doors. And the idea is you open all the glass doors and everyone goes in for this event, and then the mass moves out all at once through the whole thickness. And then Mussolini gives a speech from a balcony, the bit outside. And it's all about these huge widths of road. And then you can, with that building, yeah, the whole mask, the whole facade opens up and you all go in and you all come out. There's this big excitement. And it's much more disorderly than sort of Nuremberg rallies. And they're not military. It's everyone. The whole society is united. And that building is a kind of another cube, but it's got a domed roof, and it's much feels like something that could almost be in the Festival of Britain.
Yeah, there's a much softer edge, isn't there, around all of this stuff.
Yeah, the monument really feels funereal. It really feels like there's a body in each of those, and it is being used endlessly in films because it's a very filmic space. Obviously there wasn't a big festival in 1942.
No, circumstances intervened. They rather did. I mean, I think at some point maybe we'll talk about German fascist architecture, because I think it's more, there's kind of an interesting parallel story to be told. Maybe we can do it.
It's much worse.
It's much worse. I think ultimately, it's not really, although there are architectural works, they're really about the enormous, austere thing of alienatingly massive scale, but which is surrounded by a 10 times greater space, which is a void. And actually the void, which is there to be filled entirely with like the ideology and mindlessly subsumed mass of the folk, is much more important than the building can ever be. And actually the buildings are kind of tasteless and colourless. They have this sinister edge.
They're because literally generally all grey.
There's not very much there, apart from these occasional, the kind of literal sinister symbols that the eagles and swastikas and things.
Yeah,
it's background.
The Italians, even I'm more fond of the stuff which isn't really inherently that fascist. We don't now associate it with the ideology in Italy. But even I think the totally fascist EUR, which is 100%, I think much more successfully manages to think about what you do with a mass of people and a speaker. Like that Congress hall where you all walk out and you all walk in and there's a particular relationship with the place to speak and that they pass underneath the speaker. Whereas the huge dome for the new world capital, which is this massive Congress hall, and there's a place for Hitler to speak and you can't see it because the room is so big. So he just sticks a massive, massive eagle above it, which is kind of almost the placeholder for the person. I don't think they managed to make the ideology stick. They didn't really like the presence of modernism, and they didn't know what to do with history. So the grand civic buildings in the inside of the new Nuremberg, it's kind of like a Persian or Greek temple funerary complex, all grey and marble and huge arches. But it's so much less intelligently subverted than it is in the Italian subversions of...
The stuff they really liked, as you said before, was like, bunkers and kitsch. The houses they built for themselves are all like these little sort of chalets with checkered tablecloths and places you can take girls or boys.
Or boys, for that matter. Their favourite housing type was sort of half timbered. If it's built for the SS or to train up like concentration camp guards, you might have a few runic symbols, but it'll essentially be mock village. With the exception to which is Pora. He said, I want it to be a Butlins for National Socialism in Pomerania, I think, which was the Strength Through Joy Centre.
Oh my God. Well, I guess maybe let's save that one. I feel like we could do another one on all this.
The Nazi one will be a lot nastier.
Yeah.
Because we'll have to talk about the buildings, and the interesting buildings are for very nasty people.
Yes, bad purposes. Thanks a lot for subscribing. Thanks a lot to new subscribers. We've got a few through.
Yeah.
Very generous. We very much appreciate your contribution, and it makes a huge difference to our ability to put out good, timely, well-researched material.
Yeah, so it's good.
We can give yourself a pat on the back. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Editorial assistance by Matthew Lloyd
Roberts. Yes.
Who's Lloyd Parry? That name.
Robert Lloyd Parry is a guy who does performances of M.R. James stories. Yes, Matthew Lloyd Roberts is our editor. Yes.
Good night.
Good night, yes.